a good weekend.
Today is Friday, April 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden announces new executive orders to curb gun violence.
But they fall far short of the sweeping gun control agenda he campaigned on.
Plus, African leaders meet to discuss the ongoing crisis in Mozambique.
What we have here is a human rights and humanitarian crisis that has left hundreds of thousands displaced.
And a look into the former home of famed mystery writer Edgar Allan Poe. We'll have these stories and more. Next, U.S. President Joe Biden is making his first gun control measures, saying the nation must address a surge of gun violence. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani starts us off.
Enough, enough, enough.
The president says it's an epidemic.
And it's an international embarrassment.
With relatives of those killed in school shootings watching in the Rose Garden, the president called American gun violence an international embarrassment.
The idea that we have so many people dying every single day from gun violence in America is a blemish on our character as a nation.
He announced a half dozen executive actions, including tightening regulations on homemade ghost guns. But the president has limited power to act on guns.
There's much more that Congress can do.
But they fall far short of the sweeping gun control agenda he campaigned on. The president's urging Congress to move on background checks and other legislation.
Enough prayers. Time for some action.
Though the measures face slim prospects amid near-unified Senate GOP opposition. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Medical experts use anatomical diagrams and charts to testify on Thursday that George Floyd was killed by police pinning him to the ground. Not a drug overdose, challenging a key assertion by former police officer Derek Chauvin in his murder trial for Floyd's deadly arrest. Reuters' Chris Dignam.
A critical care doctor with an Irish brogue commanded the jury's attention on day 9 of the murder trial of Derek Chauvin. The prosecution's witness testified that George Floyd died from a lack of oxygen caused by being handcuffed face down in the street with the former Minneapolis police officer's knee on his neck.
Mr. Floyd died from a low level of oxygen.
The testimony from Dr. Martin Tobin, a pulmonary expert who treats patients in a Chicago ICU, came equipped with charts, anatomical diagrams, and mathematical formulas to confirm the county medical examiner's finding that Floyd's death was a homicide at the hands of police.
We're seeing that the level of oxygen has gone down to zero, that there is, at that point, there's not an ounce of oxygen left in his body. And again, this is totally, you can figure this out with very precise science.
Crucially, Dr. Tobin also said the medical evidence contradicted the argument by Chauvin's defense that Floyd may have died from a drug overdose and compared the restraint Floyd was in to a vice.
A healthy person subjected to what Mr. Floyd was subjected to would have died as a result of what he was subjected to.
Defense attorney Eric Nelson tried to argue that traces of fentanyl and methamphetamine found in Floyd's system may have played a role in his limited breathing.
Fentanyl is a respiratory depressant.
But prosecutor Jerry Blackwell attempted to put that argument to rest.
Did you see any depression in Mr. Floyd's ability to breathe whatsoever before he went unconscious?
No, absolutely not.
The prosecution then called to the stand a forensic toxicologist who said the levels of fentanyl and methamphetamine found in Floyd's blood were much lower than that of the average DUI case.
Would that be considered a low level of methamphetamine?
Yes, very low.
And Thursday's final witness, a surgeon from Louisville who trains police about the dangers of using pressure on a suspect's neck, said Floyd could not breathe because of Chauvin's knee.
That is not a fentanyl overdose. That is somebody begging to breathe.
Chris Dignam from Reuters. Leaders from 6 Southern African nations met this week to figure out how to address a rise in violent extremist attacks in Mozambique's volatile north, including a sophisticated attack last month that threatened the nation's gas reserves. VOA's Anita Powell looks at what is at stake in this complex corner of the coastal nation.
Here is the puzzle the presidents of Botswana, Malawi, Mozambique, South Africa, Tanzania, and Zimbabwe are trying to solve. A shadowy insurgency has taken a stranglehold over northern Mozambique, increasing their violent attacks in recent months and endangering the nation's large gas reserves. On Thursday, after 2 days of meetings between regional military and security officials and heads of state, the Southern African Development Community's top six leaders called for an immediate technical deployment to Mozambique ahead of another high-level meeting at the end of April. Legally, the body can intervene militarily in cases of intrastate conflict like this one. But Mozambique has so far been unreceptive. The latest chapter in this violent three-year saga, an attack last month by Islamic State-linked insurgents on the city of Palma, close to a multi-billion-dollar French gas project, appears to have been the final straw that motivated leaders to convene. In that highly organized attack, militants laid waste to the small seaside town and committed horrific atrocities, according to rights groups. It is a complex story, but rights groups say leaders need to focus on one issue. Fundamentally, they argue, this is a human rights crisis. Dewa Mavinga is Southern Africa Director for Human Rights Watch.
What we have here is a human rights and humanitarian crisis that has left hundreds of thousands displaced, insecure, and unable to return to their homes because of the attacks that have been ongoing. So the lack of security then spills over to affect everything else, including in terms of stability and economic programs that might be taking place in Cabo Delgado. As we have seen with the attack on Palma Town, it then disrupted all socioeconomic activities, but at the core of it is a lack of protection in terms of the rights of the citizens who were then forced to flee to Tanzania and southwards to Pemba.
The United Nations estimates 1.3 million people need urgent humanitarian assistance and that 670,000 have been pushed out of their homes by the violence. Last year saw more than 570 violent incidents in the nation's three northern provinces. Historian Yusuf Adam, a retired professor at Maputo's Eduardo Mondlane University, told VOA the problems in this region go back, way beyond the start of the insurgency in 2017. He's been studying the region since the 1970s and says he's documented growing animus in the last two decades between local landowners, who are mostly Muslim, and farmers, who are mostly Christian. He believes Mozambique's government waited too long to try to address these divides, and perhaps more importantly, to tackle the area's systemic poverty and inequality. And for that reason, he says, a military solution is no solution.
There is no military solution. People have to be heard, and things have to be negotiated, and also people's the right to land. People have to benefit also from whatever is will come out, is coming out from this mining, oil, petrol and gas operations. That's something which has to be seen and done.
Anne Mavinga says the government needs to take responsibility for its own failures. While militants have committed grievous acts, including rapes and beheadings, rights groups have also documented abuses by Mozambican security forces, including torture and extrajudicial killings. Security expert Jasmine Opperman, director of the Terrorism Research and Analysis Consortium, says the militants' tactics show their aim clearly. They're trying to sow distrust in the government. That's why the Palma attack, which grabbed headlines around the world and forced French energy giant Total to suspend its local operations, actually matters.
There is nothing for them in seizing the gas. Disruption is the important thing. Exposing the government for inability to protect the LNG sector is an important aspect. And with that, we are seeing the insurgents just gaining massive momentum. It is important to make a distinction. The LNG sector, I want to argue, has never been a primary attack, but disruption remains central.
In their communique, Southern African leaders did not say what exactly an immediate technical deployment means, what exactly it would do, or even how soon they could get their feet on the ground. Nor did they elaborate on their statement that such heinous attacks cannot be allowed to continue without a proportionate regional response. SADC will meet again in Maputo on April 28th. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Australia and the Philippines limited the use of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine on Thursday, while the African Union dropped plans to buy the shot. dealing further blows to the company's hopes to deliver a vaccine for the world. Reuters' Emer McCarthy takes it from here.
The shot, which is developed with Oxford University and considered a frontrunner in the global vaccine race, has been plagued by safety concerns and supply problems since phase 3 trial results were published in December, with Indonesia the latest country forced to seek doses from other developers. The Philippines suspended the use of AstraZeneca shots for people below 60 after Europe's regulator said on Wednesday it found rare cases of blood clots among some adult recipients, although the vaccine's advantages still outweighed its risks. Australia recommended those under 50 get Pfizer's candidate in preference to AstraZeneca's, a policy shift that it warned would hold up its inoculation campaign. The African Union says it is now exploring options with Johnson & Johnson, having dropped plans to buy AstraZeneca's vaccine from India's Serum Institute. AstraZeneca's vaccine is by far the cheapest and most high-volume launched so far, and has none of the extreme refrigeration requirements of some other COVID-19 vaccines, making it likely to be the mainstay of many vaccination programs in the developing world. But more than a dozen countries have at one time suspended or partially suspended use of the shot, first on concerns about efficacy in older people and now on worries about rare side effects in younger people. That, coupled with production setbacks, will delay the rollout of vaccines across the globe as governments scramble to find alternatives.
Emer McCarthy reports for Reuters News. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. NATO is marking the 72nd anniversary of its founding this week, and Henry Ridgewell reports the military alliance faces new challenges and enduring threats.
A familiar challenge for NATO, Russian troops conducting exercises earlier this month in Crimea, part of Ukraine forcefully annexed by Russia in 2014. Ukraine's president says there's only one solution to stop Russian aggression, for his country to join NATO. It's 72 years since Western allies signed the Washington Treaty in 1949 to create NATO, based on the principle of collective self-defense. Russia remains its biggest challenge, says analyst Jonathan Isle.
We have a Russia which is not only willing to use force in order to threaten other European countries, but has actually used force and has forcefully annexed a bit of a territory of another country into itself as little as less than 10 years ago. So it does underline the centrality of NATO as a security structure in Europe.
NATO continues to grow. North Macedonia joined in March 2020. Bosnia and Herzegovina is an official candidate, with Ukraine and Georgia aspiring members. Meanwhile, U.S. President Joe Biden has reaffirmed America's commitment to the organization. His predecessor Donald Trump once called NATO obsolete, which sent tremors through the transatlantic alliance.
The arrival of President Biden in the White House has, at a stroke, removed all such doubts.
Biden is also pushing for NATO to tackle other strategic threats, notes analyst Simona Saw.
Climate change cooperation as it pertains to security and defense, but even more broadly than this, technology, a new approach to Russia and China, a new approach to how democracy is promoted and protected against disinformation and against subversion campaigns.
NATO faces numerous challenges, including ongoing violence in Afghanistan. Continuing attacks are complicating efforts to end the almost 20-year NATO mission. Also, internal tensions are simmering, not least over defense spending.
More than 90% of the people in the European Union, they live in a NATO country. But only 20% of NATO's defense spending comes from NATO EU members.
The United States will likely maintain pressure on European members to meet the defense spending target of 2% of GDP made at the 2014 NATO summit in Wales.
President Biden was one of the architects of the Wells Defense Pledge. So in this sense, he is very much attached to the idea that Europeans have to invest, to continue to invest more in their defense.
Meanwhile, Turkey has purchased a Russian missile defense system to the dismay of NATO allies.
Even Turkey does not believe that it will be better off outside NATO rather than within the alliance.
Despite the tensions, NATO remains the bedrock of European security as the alliance enters its 73rd year. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Russia currently has more troops on Ukraine's eastern border than at any time since 2014 when it annexed Crimea and backed separatist territory seizures. And the United States says it is concerned by growing Russian aggressions. The comments followed a call in which German Chancellor Angela Merkel demanded that Russian President Vladimir Putin pull his troops back to de-escalate the situation. According to a recent report just published by Freedom House, a Washington, D.C. think tank dedicated to promoting democracy and human rights, democratic norms are under increasing threat globally. Now, to find out more about this trend and what it means, especially in Africa, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with John Taman, Director of Africa Programs at Freedom House. Mr. Taman began their conversation by stating that his organization has reported a general decline in democratic freedoms around the world every year for the past 15 years.
And that pattern is reflected in Africa. The last year that we looked at, 2020, was one of the worst years, unfortunately, in terms of regressions on democracy and freedoms in Africa.
What kinds of democratic norms are you looking for?
We're looking at political rights and civil liberties and the environment in which elections take place. We're looking at freedom of movement, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, media freedoms, and increasingly at online freedoms. So the overall freedoms that citizens enjoy in any particular country.
I note that West Africa is of particular concern.
Yeah, we've definitely seen a significant democratic decline in West Africa in recent years. And that comes after a period where West Africa did relatively well. This past year, we saw a significant decline in Cote d'Ivoire related to elections and changing term limits. Also on term limits, we saw a decline in Guinea, where the president engineered a third term. Over a number of years, we've seen a notable decline in Burkina Faso. Last year, we saw a significant decline in Mali related to the coup there. Benin had a substantial decline last year, and Benin used to be a country that really performed very well in terms of democracy. And those declines are not limited only to West Africa. We've seen notable declines in Tanzania, in Mozambique, and elsewhere.
In fairness, there have been some positive signs for democracy in Africa as well.
And it's important not to lose sight of that. Sudan has shown some real improvements over the last couple of years. Malawi had a really important improvement this past year. Mauritania has shown some quiet but important improvements as well. So there are some bright spots.
Are there any new factors that tie some of these various forms of decline together?
There are some common factors that we see. One recently is the response to COVID. We see some leaders using the pretext of COVID to clamp down more broadly, limiting political gatherings, limiting political party activities that are disproportionately applied to opposition parties. I would cite examples in Zimbabwe as one and Uganda in another, but there are additional examples as well.
What are some other emerging challenges?
We see countries that are increasingly being repressive in the digital space and learning how to use digital tools to observe some of their opponents and also to limit free expression online. And that's happened in a number of countries. Ethiopia has shut down the internet. Zambia has problematic online legislation. A number of other countries have tried to use legislative tools to limit that space. And that issue is not going away anytime soon.
What can African citizens do to push back and make their governments more responsive and accountable?
The first thing to say is that citizens are already doing a lot, and we've seen a lot of resistance and much of it effective in recent years. You look at the revolution in Sudan, you look at some of the protests in Malawi that led to a positive change there, and you even look more recently at some of the protests in Senegal, in Nigeria. Citizens have become more savvy about how to use peaceful protests and how to really challenge governments that are not serving their interests. Of course, there are great risks associated with that, especially in Sudan. Many people have died trying to peacefully stand up to the previous regime.
What else can be done to bring nations back into the democratic fold or keep them there? What are you working on?
What I work a lot on in particular is more of the civil society piece and the media piece and the international engagement and the policy piece from abroad. I think it's all a combination of those factors, you know, citizens on the streets, plus more of the civil society engagement, plus international pressure that we often look for.
That was Freedom House's Africa Programs Director John Taman speaking with my colleague, Adam Phillips. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Amid a sharp uptick in harassment and attacks in the United States against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, or AAPI people, many Asian American journalists say that they are also being targeted at work. VOA's Jason Patinkin reports.
One day after the mass killing in Atlanta that left 6 Asian American women and 2 others dead last month, at least 5 Asian American journalists were harassed while out reporting. Journalists with ethnic roots in Asia are being caught in a broader wave of hate crimes against Asian American and Pacific Islander, or AAPI, people during the coronavirus pandemic. The Asian American Journalists Association, or AAJA, has been following incidents of harassment against its members. Naomi Takuyan Underwood is the group's executive director.
So there has been an uptick, especially since last year, of Asian Americans being attacked. We've heard from our members who have experienced harassment online and on social media. We've also heard from members who are experiencing harassment on the job. And a lot of AAPI journalists also fear for their family at this very moment because of what happened in Georgia.
CNN correspondent Amara Walker was among those harassed. She said someone yelled virus at her before a live interview in the Georgia city. And VOA journalist Paris Huang says 2 white people harassed him and 3 other Asian American journalists outside the White House. Huang, who covers the White House for VOA's Mandarin service, was about to begin a live broadcast when a man and woman approached a separate crew of Korean language journalists and started asking questions.
The blonde woman said, "Did you get permission to film the White House?" And then she went on and say, "We are American. You are not. You're foreigners. We have the right to stop you filming our White House."
As Huang started speaking Mandarin on air, they came over. Huang says his producer had to block the couple with his body from interrupting their broadcast.
If you have Asian face, you are seen as foreigners, and you have less right compared to people who think they are who are Americans, which is not true. If that's people's perception of you and possible violence having conducted to other people in a similar ethnicity, that of course it make me worry when I go out to do my job on the street or in public places.
AAJA's Underwood believes the increased harassment stems from former President Donald Trump's rhetoric during the pandemic.
In light of the past administration, journalists, and especially journalists of color and Asian American journalists, are being targeted for 2 reasons: the distrust of media, as well as the increased hate incidents against Asian Americans due to the coronavirus, being called things like China virus, or the Wuhan virus, or the Kung Flu.
Female AAPI reporters find themselves targets of racism, anti-journalism, and misogyny. Sophia Choi, a journalist at WSB-TV in Atlanta, told an Atlanta Press Club panel that she has been repeatedly targeted with sexually explicit material and messages.
I think any Asian woman in the public eye will tell you, we get emails and videos and things from our constituents or our viewers that no other race seems to. I mean, I get porn sent my way, you know, quite often. And when I block somebody, they very often find another way to contact me. And they're very confused as to why I blocked them, because they thought I liked that kind of stuff. It's happened throughout my career.
Underwood says the harassment takes a mental health toll on AAPI reporters.
Asian American journalists are under a lot of strain and pain right now, but I really have to lift up the leadership that they've taken in their newsrooms and really reporting on the experiences of the Asian American community right now.
For Asian American journalists, that means covering the racism, even as they are targeted by it. Jason Patinkin, VOA News, Washington.
Hi, my name is Benjamin Eckert. I'm a park ranger at the Edgar Allan Poe National Historic Site in Philadelphia. Often people show up and they say, wow, this is like a really big house. And what they're not understanding at first is that there's actually three houses that are adjoining each other at the location. So a lot of that's like exhibit space that we've set up. But the house where Poe actually lived is the smallest of those three homes. And despite that fact, it's actually probably the largest house that Poe lived in as an independent adult. So it's kind of the nicest accommodation that he was ever able to afford. But he was renting it. He didn't own the house himself. So it's a fairly small house. And when you go inside, it's pretty bare because we don't have any of Poe's furnishings from that time period. And you know, those are just kind of lost to history at this point. When we give you a tour of the house, we kind of describe how we think each of the rooms would have been used and where the members of the household were living. At the time that Poe lived there, it was actually kind of like a suburb. The city limits of Philadelphia expanded subsequently. So it was a very booming part of the metropolitan area at that time. A lot of people were moving there. So the house had actually been newly constructed when Poe moved in. He probably was the first tenant to live at that location. I think if you were to talk to the average person who loves Poe's writing and say, make a list of all of your favorite short stories and poems by Edgar Allan Poe, over half of the works that they would cite on their list of their favorites, those would be works that were written during Poe's time in Philadelphia. I can almost guarantee you it would be hard to find a historic home of a famous person that's less opulent than this house is. And it really went through hard times just as a physical structure, too. You know, Poe lives in this house for a year, and then it went through a series of tenants in the years since then. And then about 100 years ago, the house really was abandoned. It was a derelict house for many years, and it, in fact, had people squatting in it during a lot of that time. And the way it eventually kind of got, you know, rescued and became part of the National Park Service is a wealthy department store owner in Philadelphia, a man named Richard Gimbel, really was a big fan of Edgar Allan Poe, and he purchased the house, kind of made it a museum himself, and then donated the house to the city of Philadelphia. And Philadelphia basically wanted Congress to make it into a National Historic Site, which Congress did about 40 years ago, and has been with the National Park Service ever since. Something that most people don't know when they come to the house, and something that is appropriately really creepy too, is the story of the Black Cat almost certainly was written at this location. And the basement of the house really does appear to have been kind of an inspiration for the crucial scene in the Black Cat, which ends in the basement. So if you've read the Black Cat, you might know what I'm talking about. So it's a really creepy story, and it's the basement itself is appropriately kind of eerie looking, and it's really identical in its appearance today to how it would have looked at the time that Poe lived there.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting our website at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.